boogeyman is real, and you found him.
All right, you primitive screwheads, listen up.
What's blood for, if not for shedding?
I'm your number one fan.
I like to dissect girls. Did you know I'm utterly insane?
We all go a little mad sometimes.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
7 days.
I am Dracula.
We have such sights to show you.
I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains.
I am the eater of worlds and of children.
What's in the fucking box?
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
One by one, we will take you.
Never gonna happen again!
You gotta be fucking kidding.
It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again.
Welcome to prime time, bitch!
Welcome, 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 horror fans. It is Wednesday, 7 p.m. Central Time, and it's time for another episode of the Week in Horror Podcast, the only podcast that said the words, maybe didn't say every single little syllable, but yeah, basically said them. And if you, dear horror fanatic, are listening to us at the top of the week on Sundays, remember, we do this live every preceding Wednesday right here on YouTube. So we hope to see you in the live chat. Come join us, hang out with us. This week, I am looking back at select horror films released February 4th through February 10th. And I want to thank each and every one of you for joining me tonight for what will surely be a bloody good time. I am JL. I am holding down the fort. Eugene might be popping in to join us. I know that he was down in, I think he was down shooting in College Station. He had a gig down there. So I know he's working right now, but and I think Johnny is as well, but I will be holding down the fort in case one of them pops by. So, but hi, welcome. Welcome, everybody. It's so good to see everybody, you know, if I don't hit my mic. Oh, man, got a bunch of stuff, bunch of interesting stuff to talk about tonight. And I'm hoping the guys can pop by because I'd love to get their opinions on that. But first and foremost, let's make sure that we put up that amazing Patreon banner. There's all those incredible names to help us to make this show possible. We do appreciate each and every one of your support. You guys rock. You rule. Thank you so much. We couldn't do this show and, of course, all the stuff we have going on in the background, like, you know, upcoming productions, which I cannot wait to talk about, but I can't just yet because logistics and, you know, stuff like that. But as soon as we can, look for those announcements over on our Discord or here on our YouTube channel or maybe even social media. Who knows? Maybe even Bloody Disgusting. I think that would be fucking cool. I think I'm giving away too much there, but we will get there, I promise you. But let's see who we have in the live chat tonight. Before we kick things off, I see it filling up very quickly, so that means I have to move quickly as well. I see we've got Casey Cooper's here. Good to see you, Casey Cooper. Says, well met. Good to see you, bud. Same as Rodent, no last name. Gabba Gabba to you, sir. Thanks so much for being here. And Travis Brown as well says, evening, y'all. Just watched Parents on Tubi, and it is a film to get high on. Yes, it is. Although I would be very careful about what recreational substances you utilize while watching that movie, because that one is truly weird, and it might take you to some dark places. But definitely, yes, definitely a weird one worthy of that. Good to see you, bud. Casey Cooper says, I'm considering getting Hulu just for the new Shogun. I love that book. Yeah, I remember. The book, I think if I remember correctly, it was, James Clavell's book from back in like 1975. It was part of his, I think it was like the first book in his Asia, series or series. And it's kind of like, it's loose. I think it's a loose or a fictionalized adaptation of real events. But I saw the trailer for what's coming up on Hulu, and they just showed Hiroyuki Sanada, who is one of my favorite Japanese actors, and he is absolutely amazing. I love him in everything that he does. And so, yes, I saw him and I was like, I'm sold. And it's telling a story about basically, you know, like European ship shows up, and then this guy gets involved in the political and war dynamics of what's going on in that time period in Japan. It's really, really cool, and the trailer looks amazingly. I mean, Hulu and Disney, for all their faults, have put a lot of money towards that. So I'm really looking forward to seeing it myself. It comes out, I believe, February 27th. February 27th when that debuts on Hulu. So really looking forward to that. There was actually an 80s. Back in the 80s, there was an adaptation, if I remember correctly, that aired on, I think it was like 1980 or 81, that aired on NBC over like five nights. So there has been an adaptation before in the past. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to what Hulu is going to put out, you know, especially with the money they're dumping into it. I think it's going to be an amazing series. Jasper's here. Good to see you, Jasper. Thanks so much for hanging out. And Casey Cooper says on time solo. Yep. I was on time again. Sarcasm. Good to see you. So good evening, all. Thanks so much for being here tonight. And excellent, Travis Brown. He got his TP9000 shirt. Awesome. Fantastic. I hope you like that one. I really like the artwork on that one. Our in-house guy, he did an amazing job on that. So really, really good stuff. Josh Olson does amazing work. So all of it, not just our stuff, but all, like, as an artist, like, all of his stuff is fantastic. I love his Lord of the Rings stuff. His Lord of the Rings stuff in that same style is really, really good. So you can check all that on his website at, I say it, like, every single week. Josh Olson over at badsamurai.store. You know, you can check out all of his cool artwork and get it on t-shirts and stuff like that. So he does really fantastic stuff. Dib Dib is here. Good to see you, Dib Dib. It's lurk mode engaged. You lurk over there, but we see you, bud. Thanks so much for being here. Joshua Lee as well says, good evening, everyone. Good to see you, Joshua. Thanks so much for being here. Exceptionally Average as well. Good to see you. Thanks so much for hanging out. Says, haven't made a live show in a bunch of weeks, but that's okay. You're here now, and that's what counts. We do appreciate it. Thank you very, very much. Trevor, I can fill in for Johnny O since I'm as cranky as him. I don't know if you're as cranky as Johnny O. Johnny O gets pretty cranky. Donnie does that is here. Good to see you, bud. Thanks so much for hanging out. John Monahan as well. So good evening, scary folks. Yeah, absolutely, John. Thanks so much for hanging out with us tonight. Left-handed Jedi, good to see you. Yep, Tokugawa. Yep, that's right. Exceptionally Average. Really, really interesting story. Really cool stuff. Looking forward to it. Yeah, it was like back in like 1980, Rodan. It was like back in 1980. I think it was on NBC and it aired over like 5 nights. So, but yeah, really, really good stuff. But I'm really looking forward to seeing what Hulu does with it. So let me see who else we got here. Cindy Sue is here. Says, Dale, I have an idea for a horror script. A wedding consultant who has dealt with one too many bridezillas and their grooms. Ah, yes. A wedding slasher. That would be crazy. A lot of dresses, a lot of blood. You could say that would be really, really entertaining. But thank you, Cindy Sue. Says, I came up with this idea after my son and his fiance scrapped everything 75 days before their wedding, had to start all over again. Ugh, gross. So bad. My wife and I, when we had our wedding, back in, I think it was 2013, when we got married, our planning phase, I proposed in June of 2013. We got married that September. So it was like less than 3 months of planning to execution, because we were not picky, and we got everything that we could afford. We had everything that we wanted. The only thing I was insistent on was an open bar. So it had to be an open bar. But, I was like close to 100 people. So, but we got it all done. So it's like it just kind of all fell together, you know, just fell in place. The photographer was perfect. The cakes were perfect. I got my groom's cake, you know, and we got our awesome cake. And then the dress was, you know, she found it on the first try. She went out looking for it. It was like, bam, that's the dress. And then everything just happened, you know, and then we didn't even need to, I think we had a planner, but it was like the easiest job in the world for her, because every recommendation she made was perfect. It's like, here's a photographer. Great. Here's where you're going to get your cake. Great. Here's where you're going to get your centerpieces. Great. Here's the venue. Great. And that was pretty much it. It was like the easiest process in the world. It was wild. And here's where you're going to get all your alcohol. And then here's all the food. Here's going to do the catering. So it just kind of like slammed together in like less than 3 months, and then bam, we had a wedding with 100 people there. It was really, really fun. But I know weddings, but I understand they can be stressful. I also know how they cannot be stressful. So Javier Hara, good to see you. Thanks so much for hanging out tonight. Says Jello. Good to see you. Angel Vera as well says, what up, horror fiends. Good to see you, Angel. Let me see. Shinju says, is the TP9000 in the shop for its 5,000 hour rebuild? It's getting close. We fortunately have not had to break it out, you know, recently, because we've all been pretty much kind of in agreement to some of the latest films we've talked about. I guarantee you it's not going to pop out tonight. At least I don't think. I don't think it's going to pop out tonight. But then again, I'm by myself and Johnny's not here to like really, you know, bring it out and try to rein me in. So I don't know. We're going to find out. Let me see what we got. Who else we got here? There's an April. Well, give them my congratulations when they are able to settle that wedding down. But congratulations to them for taking the vow. It's pretty cool. Anna, good to see you. Thanks for hanging out tonight. Always happy to see you. Let me see who else we got. Dr. Nimrod is here. Says, hello, everybody. Good to see you, Dr. Nimrod. Thanks so much for hanging out. Yeah, we did get lucky, Cindy. We really did. The deading planner. I fucking love that. TM that. I fucking love it. I really do. Yeah, thank you, Dr. Nimrod. Yes. It was our eldest daughter. I don't want to like try. I know it's sad and I don't want to bring like the whole thing down, but our eldest dog, Shotzi, passed away suddenly. It was very, very fast. Her decline was the most rapid I have ever seen. And it was wild. How quickly it happened. We went to the vet. Vet tried to do what she did for her, but she continued to decline. Then we actually were like in the process of rushing her to the emergency room. The problem is that we live so rurally that to get a vet on the weekend was really, really hard, but we did it. And it's pricey, but we did it. And the vet did what she could, but then she began to decline. And the nearest emergency room to us is like an hour away. So we had, and she wouldn't move. She wouldn't like lift. She wouldn't like move at all. So we had to do all the lifting. She was a big dog. So we had to cart her. We had to get her in the car, and then we were rushing down to the emergency vet, to the emergency room, like the ER, the animal ER in Tulsa. And unfortunately, she did not make the ride, which was just crushed us. She'd been with us for 9 years, and we got her off the street. She lived an amazing life. You know, she was happy and. You know, we had an absolute blast with her and Jingles. Now the original dogs that we brought from Texas, unfortunately they're both passed. So, but they both had amazing lives. So we did and they taught us so much that we can pass on to the two that we currently have, which is Oso and Torque, who are our other two rescues. So, you know, they just made our household, both of them made our household amazing, but she was a great sassy britches dog. She was just absolutely amazing. So, but yeah, I don't want to bring everything down, but she was an incredible dog and it was, you know, it's a shame. Definitely left-handed Jedi. She was, yeah, wonderfully spoiled, but she was well-trained, well-fed and, got everything she needed with her hypo, because she had hypothyroidism and she had hip dysplasia but ultimately it was her kidneys that just went. And we think it was genetic because Jingles, who we thought was her dad, was her father. Jingles went the same way, the same condition. Like his kidneys suddenly declined on him around the exact same age, around 9 years old. And Shotzi was just like 9 years old. So it happened. But with Jingles, it lingered because we dumped everything we could in helping him out, but we realized we were just like prolonging it. And so that was just unnecessary. But with Shotzi, it happened so fast. It was like less than 48 hours from the onset of symptoms to she was gone, even with intervention. So it was just a shame. But you are right, John Monahan. Dogs are better than most people. They absolutely are. So, but yeah, thank you so much, Sir Little Wolf. I appreciate it. And good to see you. Thanks so much for hanging out tonight. I don't want to bring like the mood down. It was really, really rough. Like, you know, the first, cause she just passed on Sunday. But we dealt with it. We handled it and we knew what to expect. And it was just kind of it just took us by surprise. But she was an amazing dog, you know, an absolutely incredible dog. So, and no, I will not be visiting the pet cemetery. definitely not. Yes. Sometimes dead is better. Yeah, definitely. But she was a good dog. She was an excellent, excellent dog. She was fantastic. Really, really good. And I love rescues. So I know that Torque and Oso will not be the last rescues we bring into this house. I have no doubt that there will likely be a third dog in our future. Is that, you know, if we meet one, if we happen to run across one, knowing me, it'll probably be a stray off the street because that's typically what I like. I see, oh, a stray dog. It's got no collar. Oh, I can't find its owner. I either take it to the SPCA that we have a no-kill shelter that's nearby. Run by the Washington County. So I drive over to that county and I'll always drop them off there because I know that they don't kill dogs there. They don't kill animals there. But if I find it and they're small and they're nice and they're well tempered, then I usually end up taking them home and I'll just make them mine. Register them with the city and he's like, hey, now we have a new dog. So that happens way too often. So because I bring all the animals home, that's what I do. But yeah, she was amazing, and she taught what she taught us. We're gonna pass on to our current dogs and the ones that come after that. So an amazing dog who taught us so much. Same with Jingles, because each one that you have teaches you how to be a better parent for the next one, and then you just get better and better as each additional pet comes into your life. So. But yeah, she was amazing. She was an incredible dog. Sassy, sassy dog, especially in her old age. Sassy dog. All right. But thank you very much. I want to give a huge thank you to all for all the condolences, everybody who reached out via YouTube to with the well wishes. We do appreciate that. Both my wife and I both appreciated that very, very much. So thank you very much. You know, it meant the world to us. And she had an amazing life. Whoop, I'm hitting my mic again. So appreciate it. Thank you very much, Dr. Nimrod, as well. But Torque and Oso doing fantastic. As a matter of fact, they're chilling out. We had our runtime, went out, did our runtime, and now they ate, and now they are just chilling in the living room right now. They're watching dog television, because we found this YouTube channel that runs for like 10 hours that does nothing but like dog-centric stuff, like squirrels and birds, all kinds of stuff. And the two of them just get enthralled when they watch. They sit there and stare at the screen. So yeah, that keeps them occupied. But yeah, just hanging out. Yeah, good dogs. Yeah, now back to the morbid horror films. Absolutely, Dr. Nimrod. Skit Scratcher's here. Good to see you, Skit Scratcher. Good to see you. Thanks so much for hanging out. Oh, yeah, definitely. All right, so bunch of stuff to do tonight. And, oh, man, I'm hoping that Eugene will pop in, because I want him to see the coming trailer, even though he might not be able to see it. I don't know. I guess one of them. First and foremost, I was kind of bummed to hear that Black Summer has been canceled over at Netflix, which really kind of depressed me, because Black Summer season 1 and 2 were both amazing. Even though it was weird, because Black Summer was a spinoff of Z Nation over on Sci-Fi, and Z Nation was just kind of campy, silly, zombie fun, you know, kind of like a drama and comedy. And I never really got into it, but then Black Summer came out with Jamie King, and I was like, this show is fucking amazing. It is brutal. The cinematography was inspired and amazing. And it lasted for 2 seasons, was fantastic, but now it's suddenly been canceled, as, you know, streaming services are wont to do. So I was really kind of annoyed to hear about that Black Summer will not be getting a third season, which is just annoying as piss. There's an interesting movie coming out called Tarot, which I'm really looking forward to, and I can't wait to show the trailer to y'all if you haven't seen it yet. Cindy Sue said Netflix canceling something good. Never heard of that before. Exactly what I'm talking about. All right. Dr. Nimrod, who's been thank you so much, has been a member of the Army of the Dead for 6 months. We do appreciate that, bud. Thank you for that support. You rock. And if you too want to be a member of the Army of the Dead, use the cool emoji. See all those green names? They're all channel members. They have access to all the horror icon emojis I made for you and the channel badge. So we appreciate that support, bud. Thank you very much. And then, of course, details are starting to leak out about Thanksgiving 2. Holy shit, they greenlit that sequel in a heartbeat. You know, but Thanksgiving was a pretty fucking good movie. So, but yeah. And, of course, Cillian Murphy, fresh off his amazing success with Oppenheimer, is producing Danny Boyle's 28 Years Later, which will be the third installment in the 28 Days trilogy, in that Rage Zombie trilogy. So that's coming down the pipe, and Sony has officially picked it up. So we've got a distributor, and we've got a producer, and we got Danny Boyle doing his thing. And I know that Alex Garland is coming back for that as well. So I'm really looking forward to 28 Years Later, which should be very, very interesting. Oh, let's see. 28, yep. Love, Death, and Robots is amazing. Left-Handed Jedi, amazing content. Love, Death, and Robots and Black Mirror, both fantastic. But Love, Death, and Robots is just... it's up so many alleys. You know, it's just, it's horror, it's sci-fi, it's drama, it's comedy. You know, it's amazing stuff. I love it. Love, Death, and Robots, fantastic. The three robots discussing the now, like, you know, extinct planet where all humans have gone extinct. The three robots kind of like, you know, cataloging and talking about everything, about the ruins of human society. It's just too good. It's just too brilliant. All right. Well, I think I've killed enough time trying to hold out for Eugene to be here, but I would agree. Travis Bound, Love, Death, and Robots is this generation's heavy metal. I would agree with that, absolutely. All right, so Oh, Lovely, Dark, and Deep. I did catch the trailer for that, and I'm very curious about that one as well. I love single-take films about people in extraordinary situations. It reminded, the vibe of that film reminded me much of The Vigil, which was a horror film that centered around ancient Jewish mythology. So, but The Vigil was amazing. And so the vibe of Lovely, Dark, and Deep, and as well as the cinematography, reminded me of that. So it's only instead of being in a house with the threat, the individual is in the woods with the threat. So I'm very, very curious about that one. I really, really am. All right, Poughkeepsie. Currently watch Poughkeepsie Tapes. Poughkeepsie Tapes is kind of there. Found footage, you know. But yeah. But I get it, definitely. All right. So first up, very first thing that I want to bring up is I caught a trailer for a film that actually came out, is a British film that came out in 2022, but it will not see its release until this year. I believe it is coming out February 9th. So, but I found this to be really, really intriguing and extremely well shot and very, very creepy. If you have not heard of it, the film is called Out of Darkness, which is really, really fascinating. It is essentially a Stone Age slasher or Stone Age monster slasher film, which I find really intriguing. Good to see you, Sally Skellington. Thanks so much for hanging out tonight. Appreciate you being here. But I wanted to show you guys the trailer. So here it is, the trailer for the upcoming horror film, Out of Darkness from Bleecker Street. Let's cue up the terror tube. All right, that was the trailer for Out of Darkness. And see, a lot of people are kind of digging on that one. But yeah, I don't think it's Joshua Lee. I don't think it's a Wendigo film. And I like Travis Brown says, has feels at the beginning scene of the X-Files 1998 film. Yes, when the two cavemen or the two Neanderthals are running through the snow after the alien. Really, and the Left-Handed Jedi says, getting a bone tomahawk vibe. There's all kinds of vibes that are in this one. Considering the pedigree of the people behind this one, you know, like with It Comes at Night and Saint Maud, there's an amazing level of talent that's gone into this. So Out of Darkness is scheduled to premiere here in theaters in the States in February 9th, 2024. Oh, I found it really, really interesting that the language that the characters speak in that is, I believe what they call it there is Tola, and Tola was created for the film, but it is loosely based on the Basque language. And Basque is an actual language that was spoken in France and was spoken in that time in the area of France, which led to the inspiration of a lot of other European languages before the Indo-European influences came in. So, but an ancient language that they kind of like cultivated their own off of the Basque language, which I found is really cool. You can see the inspirations because of all of the good press that came off of Prey. And I agree with you, Travis Brown says, no doubt that this is inspired by Prey, is that by allowing the characters to speak in their native Navajo. And then the only English that was coming along was the people who spoke English, but the people who spoke French. And then you had the one dude who spoke French and Navajo because he was a guide. And so I love the interplay of that, how the characters had that natural division because of the languages they speak. And so really, really interesting stuff. But I dig that they went in that direction. There's going to be subtitles, obviously. But I think it's going to be cool. The movie stars Chukwumodu, Kit Young, Sophia Oakley-Green, Iola Evans, Luna Mwezi, and Arno Luning. And when this film premiered back in 2022, because it dropped 2022 and it premiered, I believe, at the 2023 British Independent Film Awards. And it was nominated for 5 awards at the BIFAs. And then Oakley Green won Best Breakthrough Performance for her role in the film. So yeah, we're looking at the BFI London Film Festival back in 2022. Slated for 2024 for release this year. I think it's going to be Basque, Basque, Sir Little Wolf, not Basque language, but certainly he said fish language. But I'm really looking forward to this one. I think it looks phenomenal. It's extremely well shot, and I like what they're going to do with it. So I'm very excited about Out of Darkness. Out of Darkness releases February 2024 here, February 9th, 2024. So I'm really looking forward to that one coming out. It should be very, very interesting. A Paleolithic horror film. I think it's so freaking cool. There's the man. I believe he is coming in via his phone.
Hey, what's going on?
Not much, not much. So are you driving back right now?
Yeah, I'm driving back right now. I'm about 2 hours away from home.
Cool. So you were down shooting. What were you shooting down in College Station?
So I was filming some interviews and some procedures for an esthetician. It was for a marketing company that specializes in like marketing beauty spas. So we like interview them and they talk about like, these are the products of skin revitalization and a bunch of other complex stuff that uses a lot of needles and numbing creams and electric shocks and all kinds of stuff so that you can stay healthy and beautiful.
Nice. Cause there is no beauty without pain. There never is no beauty without pain. I like it.
Yeah, the one gun that looks like a giant tattoo gun that causes you to bleed a lot, like, it's not worth it. Just not.
fun. Well, definitely, yes. Left-handed Jedi says drive safe. Absolutely drive safe. And Casey Cooper says, I hope to God Eugene didn't create the storyboards. Yeah, that would be a completely different type of business. It absolutely would. So I'm
more curious. Adult business.
Right. I'm curious, Eugene. Have you heard any? We just watched the trailer. I just showed the trailer to the live chat for Out of Darkness, which is an upcoming horror film from Bleecker Street that is essentially a like Paleolithic like, you know, monster or slasher film.
So I've seen the trailer already for it.
Oh, awesome. Cool.
And the trailer looks fantastic.
Doesn't it? It looks so fucking good.
I would love to see more prehistoric horror. I think it's something that's not utilized very often, maybe because of the difficulty in shooting it. But there's so much that's unknown about that time period in human history that you can really have a lot of fun with.
I think it's probably because, well, I agree with you on that. Probably because one, production values in order to recreate that kind of thing would be, I think, is really, really difficult. Is really, really expensive. So you got to make sure that the money's there. But I think also because just waking up every day and facing the day was horror enough, because it's not like life was easy then. You know, when the life expectancy of a human being was somewhere in like their 20s or their early 30s. So it's kind of like, you know, it's like, man, got to do another day. It's a fucking horror movie out there. Just looking for food to survive and not be eaten by something else.
Just the world itself is a horror movie.
Exactly. Just nature be scary. Nature is what is fucking terrifying. And human beings trying to survive 45,000 years ago, that just, you know, it's like, do you have enough animal skins? Do you have a sharp enough spear? Are you accurate with your weaponry? Can you find food and clean water to drink? Just rough. Don't get eaten by a cave bear or a saber-toothed cat or, you know, something out there that will readily eat you. You know, in Africa, there were eagles that ate people, children, eagles that would take away children because they were big enough to do that. It's kind of like, you know, it's too much. It's just too much. We got it so easy these days.
Not to mention, let's say you get injured. If you break your leg, done.
You're done. You're done.
Yeah, you're done. You get sick, done.
Sir Little was like, look, I caught a fish. Oh, a cave wolf. Exactly. Freaking brutal. Just, you know, it's just like, that's the horror film. The horror film opens up, waking up in the cave. Time to go find food. Oh, I'm dead. Shit. You know, like that's Sir Cab says, I watch horror movies to relive the anxiety born of repressing 10,000 years of fight or flight instincts. Absolutely. That's where it comes from. It's like where every freaking thing out there will kill you.
Everything. Bear, run. Panther, fight.
Oh, friggin' nuts. But it looks really good, and I think it's a beautifully shot film, and I think it should be real. I think it's going to really pop. Plus, I love Bleecker Street. Bleecker Street is a great production background, so I'm really looking forward to what they pop out. Travis Brown says, I'm getting lag on my end. Am I lagging a bit? Let me know, because I got the stream here on another screen. Everything looks okay to me. So I keep an eye on it as best I can. All right. So, but as Alex likes to say very often, that we have horror movies to talk about. So we're going to dive in. And we got some interesting ones to talk about tonight. So I'm really fascinated by some of the stuff that we've got, especially this first one coming up. Eugene, you're driving, so I'll do that. You want me to do the intros?
Yeah, I can't. I don't have another screen to pull up the information.
And I don't need you suddenly cutting out in the middle of it, like, you know, oh shit, and then he's gone all of a sudden. It's been a pleasure. Oh, I'm out. So anyway, this first film coming up. Oh, it froze a couple times, but your audio was clean. Awesome. Okay, maybe I see that I'm a little. I'm not on Wi-Fi. I'm hard connected, so it's a little funky. I have no idea. So, but apparently it's still looking okay to me. But I guess we'll find out. Audio's been clean. All right. Well, this first film we're going to talk about tonight released February 4th, 2014 here in the States, even though it came out 2011 in its home of Norway. But we have the Norwegian horror film Dark Souls. So let's cue up the Terror Tube. Check out this trailer. So that was the trailer for Dark Souls. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the Norwegian. Mørkesjeler, I think, is what it was called. But yeah, the film, let's see. So directed by Cesar Ducasse and Matthew Patou, written by Cesar Ducasse and Matthew Patou, starring Morten Ruda, Keir Howden Sidness, Ida Elise Brock, Johanna Gustafsson, Jan Harstad, Carl Sundby, and Henrik Scheel. The film follows a small town in Norway where people are suddenly being attacked by a masked man, you know, just grabbing them and drilling into their heads and supposedly killing them. But then their bodies come back to life and exude this expel this black viscous fluid all over the place. And they get to a point where they begin decomposing. I would say that they're very docile zombies, but then they start grabbing other people and infecting other people and turning them into zombies. And it turns into this, and then this one father whose daughter was attacked, who was the first victim, the father goes on a mission to try and find out what exactly is happening and if he can stop it, and discovers it's a massive conspiracy that's going on. So this was an odd one. I was both fascinated and kind of like, I'll say the energy this film almost took me is kind of like it was a nice buildup and then it kind of petered. But every time it started to slow, it picked up a little bit and got a little bit more fascinating. The sequence of the dad in the factory when he found the heart of the conspiracy and he's like, you know, dude, that whole sequence I thought was really, really good. But overall, this is just a kind of a solemn, slow burn homage to other horror films, because there's a lot of references to other zombie flicks that are in this. I think there's homages to 28 Days Later. There's homages to Night of the Living Dead, to Dawn of the Dead. There's a bunch of stuff that's kind of like where to other films like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You can see these little moments that were inspired that are not absolutely recreated, but you can see, oh, cool, that's like a little throwback, like a little like, it's like, hey, I got this. But otherwise, kind of a strange little film that I think was made kind of better by being Norwegian, which is really, really it's weird. And Sarcasm brings up, I was truly disappointed to be missing the why of the whole old man's conspiracy. True, it's ambiguous. There is no reason as to why this old guy is doing it. It's just a mad scientist making a zombie army. You know, total ambiguity in the storyline, and all of it is centered. All of it is focused on the characters, on the detective and the father searching for, you know, who attacked his daughter. Really, really weird shit, but fascinatingly shot. You know, I really enjoyed the cinematography in this one.
Yeah, this was an odd one. I typically like the pacing better in foreign films than I do American films, because in a lot of foreign films, it's more of like an open style. Like American films feel like, oh, we have to get a certain pacing or we're going to lose the audience. Whereas foreign films don't have to follow that formula. A slow burn can be a slow burn. But this was, it was strange. And it didn't necessarily bother me the fact that it didn't explain why. Because I like that one saying, why, who cares? He's just doing it.
Right. Yeah.
So that was fine. But it was kind of an art house feel to it. Like, it just, you see the homages, but you don't really see. It was odd. That's kind of how I felt. I wasn't like, man, I really like this, or man, I really hate this. I was kind of like, at the end, huh. That was it.
Right. And it kind of ends on that. It ends on that kind of, I thought, honestly, myself, I thought it was going to end on kind of a Night of the Living Dead moment, which is also what kind of like got me on that, because you have the father manages to escape the factory by wearing a disguise. It looks like one of the bad guys. So he's able to get out. And then he crashes his car and he's wandering around as, you know, basically the apocalypse has descended upon the town of Norway. There's like zombies everywhere, and there's like bad guys in the orange jumpsuits with the masks, and they're like drilling people all over the place, and it's absolute fucking chaos. And he's wandering about in kind of like this daze from this car accident. And I thought, holy shit. You know, he's the one guy who's going to try and make it home. He's going to wind up getting shot or being put down by somebody because he's wearing a disguise. I thought it was going to go for a Night of the Living Dead kind of ending, where it's kind of like, you know, kind of like the bad ending. He's like, you know, the hero survives all the way to the end, only to be taken out by the ignorant populace. I thought it was going to go that route, but it didn't. But it did end, and it did. We did have the bad ending where he gets home and his daughter has infected his student. And so, and that's where that video is like, and then it just ends. So I found there were some really fascinating directorial choices that I thought were made in this one, that I thought, that I got the feeling that were made strictly in order to kind of buck the established formula for shooting films like this. And so areas where typically you'd have like really, really tight, really taut pacing were deliberately slowed down. The ending, you know, the ambiguity of why everything was going on. Yeah, they gave the whole conspiracy plot with the old homeless guy who kind of like gave some insight into the discovery of this nasty black oil, the stuff that infects people down in the ocean. And then all of a sudden this old man comes out of nowhere, and then he's turning everybody into like zombies and shit for his own personal army. But he's also tracking their names specifically, even though he's not interacting with them, which is, so there's a lot of unanswered questions, but I think that was deliberate. So I just got the feeling of deliberate. Now, it could be a lack of money issue, that there were aspects of the plot that they couldn't go into because of a lack of funds, but you know, but maybe not. And I agree with sarcasm. Technically, the film was very, very sound. Well lit, well filmed, no sound issues, no ADR issues. I thought that the effects in the sound quality, especially in the hospital with those long empty corridors, was done extremely well. Just that the script didn't go anywhere. It just kind of like, it was almost like in meteor. It was almost like a film veritas. Like, here's this moment, you know, all of a sudden there's a spate of these brutal attacks, and then people are turning into zombies, and then the apocalypse descends, and then that's it.
Yeah, it's hard to really dive into this one because of the way it is, the fact that it's like, okay, well, here's a little snippet. I didn't think you would do the Night of the Living Dead ending, but I was expecting the bad ending. I kind of expect the bad ending. The thing, I thought it would be more towards like he would have to sacrifice himself.
Right.
In an effort to save his daughter, but also at the same time, that's more of an American cliche. Like, if you're going to have the bad ending, then you go out in a blaze of glory kind of thing, or sacrifice for your loved ones. With that. And the thing about the Night of the Living Dead ending, though, and what makes that ending so good is because there's so many implications on top of it. Now that movie definitely touches on race.
Oh, yeah, like, 100%.
Yeah, yeah. It's Romero says it doesn't talk about race, but it talks about race. It does. Yeah, like, we all got it. But, and like, you know, you're right.
Uh-huh.
But you're right. I don't think it was a budgetary issue, because despite the fact it didn't seem like a big budget movie, it felt like they had the money they needed to tell the story they wanted.
Right. Exactly. Now,
so there. So therefore, any story choices was either a plot hole or deliberate.
Okay, so you bring that up, and it was interesting because reviews of the film and interviews with the director, it was pretty much pointed out that the film itself, the general sense of the film is conveying how people will act irrationally in, you know, in these grand situations, how people don't make good decisions in the midst of all of this craziness that's going on. So like that people are inherently irrational when it comes to extreme emotion. So like the father being, you know, irrationally acting with his daughter, who, you know, is obviously so far gone that, but he can't let go of her. You have the detective who is acting irrationally as well. You have the police force acting irrationally, just people. That's what it's all about. The film is like, so for a lot of people, the film came off as more tedious because it's like watching people constantly make terrible decisions and doing like the absolute wrong thing like every single time. But it was done, in my opinion, it was done in a believable sense. It's like people reacting to the extreme things that are all around them, the extreme things going on around them. And I thought that was a good sense. So I understand what the director, what Dukas and Petula were trying to convey in this one, with the limited budget and the story that they had. It's just that it could have been tightened up a little bit, I think. But overall, the big selling point of this one is the excellent practical effects. So the practical effects were really good. The drill kills were pretty intense. And it's a savage little film. It's got some seriously savage moments with some, you know, that are interspersed with some slow burn areas and a lot of like gooey, gloppy, gross, you know, zombie effects, because, you know, like spewing, like decomposing people and spewing black shit everywhere. So really, really, just a very, very odd little film that kind of slipped under the radar because it came out of Norway.
Yeah, and going back to people overreacting, I've been almost killed more by people overreacting to danger than actually danger itself.
Right.
So I really got that. And though I always believe it is harder to write smarter people and people that don't overreact, because then you can't use that as a cop-out where, oh, well, they can make a stupid decision. They're going to overreact and make a stupid decision and die, which we see in so many horror films. I've always liked the smarter character. I like the character that is like, oh, when I watch it, I go, man, that's what I would do. Then when that character gets smoked, I'm like, oh, shit, I would have died.
Right.
That's always way more impressive.
So I found it really, really fascinating. Just kind of like a really, really weird, this one got me. I'm thinking about going back and watching it again. I only watched it one time for this week, but I'm honestly thinking about going back. It's currently on Tubi. But I'm thinking about going back and watching it again, just so I can see some of the little choices that were made in this one from both a directorial standpoint and an actor standpoint, to kind of see if anything further is conveyed in the subtext. Because I think this one, despite it on the surface, is pretty much just a spewy zombie film, I think that there's more writing on the subtext of this film that I think the gore and the zombie effects kind of overshadowed, and the kind of like obnoxious choices that a lot of the characters make. But then again, it's also, I think the biggest issue is that American audiences approaching this one, we react in a specific way to specific stressors. And so when we watch an American character react in a way that Americans expect to react, then we can identify with that. But Norwegians, the way they internalize and express stress is far different than Americans do. And I think that's where it's kind of lost in translation, where the way a Norwegian will react to something going on is far different than we will. The way they internalize stress and the way that they react to that stress and how they, you know, you don't see that in this film, which makes it kind of like, you know, why would he do that? Because they're not us. And I think that's one of the big things. Same with the Japanese. If you notice in the Japanese films, especially in films like Ringu and the Grudge and Ju-on, those characters don't react to what's going on around them like American actors would, like Americans would. Okay. Which is why I thought it was fantastic in the Grudge remake, because you get to see Japanese characters react to the shit, and you get to see an American actor react to the shit as well, or an American react to this, and it's completely different to showcase the cultural dichotomy. So I found it really, really intriguing. They do not serve any lutefisk in this film. They don't. So at least I didn't see any. So unlike in There's Something in the Barn. There's Something in the Barn is hilarious because there's a lutefisk scene in that one. And the way the Americans react to the lutefisk is just hilarious to me. Pickled, or was it fermented whitefish? Fermented whitefish fermented in lye. So, but I will say this, I fucking love Norwegian horror films. There's so many fucking good ones. Rare Exports is one of my favorites because it's a Christmas horror film. And because in Norway, Krampus is much bigger there than it is here in the States. And I fucking love it because, you know, fucking Rare Exports is one of my favorite Norwegian horror films. But there's so many good ones. UKPI is here. Good to see you, bud. Says, hello, peoples. Hope you're all good and scared. Definitely. We are terrified. Sir Kevin says, they externalize their stress with black metal. Oh, yeah. Good point. Excellent point there, bud. All right. But given that this is a Norwegian horror film, and there's so many good Norwegian horror films that have come out, and this one was I know it was a weird one. It was a very, very weird one. Very kind of like, it kind of like, I liked it because it took me out of the box. I was like, and I had to, and it made me think. It challenged me in different ways as both a filmmaker and as a member of the audience. And I thought the choices that were being made were not just that, because when you've done this as long as both Eugene and I have done, or as Johnny as well, we can watch a movie and we can see that when a director makes a choice, that the director doesn't know what they're doing. It's like they made that choice because they didn't know what they were doing, or they made that choice because they think that they were doing this, but they did it wrong. So we can tell. And when actors make certain choices, like, they made that choice because they didn't understand the script, you know, that kind of thing. So we can recognize those things when watching a movie. And the choices here made in this film, in this Norwegian film, were fascinating in that they were not your typical formulaic choices, but they were intentional. And that leads me to believe that there's something more going on in the subject, which I think warrants a second viewing from me to try and pick up on those little details that the director might be hinting in there, trying to understand that. I could be wrong though, but I think it does. But my question for the audience tonight, Travis Brunson, I'm getting Sir Stroming nightmares after tonight. I like the Sir Stroming. I did. The only issue I had with the Sir Stroming was that it was so fucking salty. That's it. It was like beyond salty. It's like, why does it have to be that salty? And I got the Sir Stroming with the roe. So my Sir Stroming had eggs in it. So, which apparently makes it even more salty. So that was the only issue, was eating the Sir Stroming was literally the saltiest food I've ever eaten in my life. I have no idea how I didn't have a stroke that night. I consumed so much salt in that one sitting, but yeah, super salty. I seriously, I felt biologically changed when I ate that shit. Like there is something fundamentally off balance. Okay, I need a banana to kind of like balance out the sodium, potassium, you know, levels in my body. It was wild. Jay Kristoff is here, says, hey, Eugene, good to see you, Jay. Thanks so much for hanging out. Yes, it was salt fish.
Hey, what's going on?
Salt fish, that's what it was. All right, but my question for the audience is, what, in your opinion, is the best Norwegian horror film? There have been many that have come out, and a lot of them are really fantastic. Now, whether it's set in Norway or was a Norwegian production, there are many, many good ones. I mean, I think, if I remember correctly, it was Let the Right One In. That was Norwegian, wasn't it?
I think so. I thought that was Swedish, but I could be wrong.
Oh, it might be. Yeah, Stockholm. Yeah, that was it. Said Stockholm. That was a Swedish one. So, but yeah. But let us know down in the comments below or at weekendhorror@gmail.com what you think is the best Norwegian horror film. There are not many out there, but they are out there, and they are quite good if you can hunt them down and find them. So really good stuff.
I'll tell you the one that missed a mark was The Thing 2011. That missed a mark. That missed a golden opportunity.
Missed the mark hard. Absolutely. Left-handed Jedi brings up Troll Hunter. I liked Troll Hunter. I thought Troll Hunter was really fucking good. Did you have a chance to see that one?
No, I haven't. I saw the trailer for it. I wanted to see it.
Troll Hunter was fantastic. You know, basically about a bunch of documentarians that go out to research trolls and find out that they're real, and they run into a dude who works for the Norwegian government, who goes out and basically is like, animal control, but he's troll control. So if they like get out of hand or they get sick, he'll go out and he'll put them down, you know, to make sure that they don't become nuisances to the public. They don't, it doesn't become public knowledge that trolls actually exist. Fascinating little film, extremely well shot, very cool shit. But I enjoyed Troll Hunter. I really did. Rare Exports is still my favorite. I fucking love Rare Exports. Thought it was so great. Rare Exports was so good that the young boy who is the lead, the young actor who was the lead in that, he's the one who played in that. He got the lead across from Sam Jackson in the film where Sam Jackson played the president. And he crash lands in an Air Force One. Air Force One gets shot, basically gets taken down, and he crash lands in Norway. And he meets this young boy who helps him survive the people who are trying to kill him.
Oh, yeah. I remember that movie.
Yes. Yes. And so it was the same kid. Same kid, but, you know, came over from Rare Exports. It was fantastic stuff. All right. Let's move on to our second film, which I'll admit I'm a little bit annoyed by. Damn you, Charles Band. Damn you, Charles Band, and my mercurial relationship with this man and his production company. So this film released February 6th, 1992. I believe this was a direct-to-video film, if I remember correctly. I think it was. Direct-to-video? Yeah, I think it was direct-to-video. But let's check it out. Here's the trailer. Let's cue up the Terror Tube. Here's the trailer for Netherworld. Yes, that was the that was the only trailer I could find for Netherworld. It was the one where, you know, we dropped on VHS or whatever. But yes, Netherworld, written and directed by David Schmoller, who we've talked about before on the show, and starring Michael Benedetti, Denise Gentile, Holly Floria, Robert Sampson, Holly Butler, and Alex Dafker. The film follows a young man, Corey, who inherits his father's estate in Louisiana, only to find that upon arrival, that his father plans to sacrifice his soul to live again, because his dad is like deep in the, I guess, whatever fucking like magic shit that was going on. It's kind of a weird combination of like of Wicca and voodoo and all kinds of weird shit in this film. So this is the issue. This is primarily the issue that I fucking have. So I love Charles Band. I do. But I said I have a mercurial relationship with this man because I consider Charles Band and you can correct me if you jump in if you disagree with me. I consider Charles Band and Lloyd Kaufman kind of in the same camp, okay? Doing their own thing. Making the movies that they want to make. And I fucking love Lloyd for it. We all do. We all love Lloyd for that. And I also love Charles for that, because Charles Band has a specific vision that he wants, and the way he makes his movies, a specific formula that he has in play that he kind of established all his own. And we see this in films like Puppet Master and Demonic Toys and Doll Man and Puppet Master versus Demonic Toys and Doll Man versus Demonic Toys and whatever. Okay. Same with Lloyd. Lloyd's got his own thing. And we've talked extensively about Troma Productions. And so I put them both in the same camp. My problem is that with Lloyd, you know what to expect. Charles Band will always try to do something that, even though he's holding to his own standards, will always try to do something interesting and unique and strange and whatever to kind of set Full Moon apart from everybody else. And Travis Brown brings up this standard Full Moon craziness. Well, kind of. That's the issue that I have here, is because unlike other Full Moon productions, okay, this has to be the weirdest and the biggest letdown of a Full Moon production that I have ever seen in my life. Because this didn't feel, except for moments, there were moments that were definitely Full Moon productions. The hand coming out of the wall with the snake fingers and shit like that. People turning into birds. You know, like the blurred out scene with the guys in the back with the fucking bird head and shit. The bird at the end, he turns his dad into a bird, and the bird's got like half like the fit, like the obviously puppet bird is like, ah, you saw it in the trailer. That's all full moon shit. That's easily recognized. That's definitely full moon tropes. But the rest of this film did not play like that. I mean, there were even common things like the hot chicks being constantly randy, because Charles Band was kind of like a soft core auteur here. So hot chicks who are constantly on the verge of, or constantly want sex, guys who are somewhat aloof and kind of just like deal with it. So it's kind of like role reversal of the prawn dynamic. And so that's all classic Charles Band, classic full moon shit. You know, girls looking, but then he throws stuff in this film, like people looking directly into the camera, like fucking a la Jonathan Demme in Silence of the Lambs. So he utilizes that a lot, like people looking directly into the camera, straight down the barrel, okay? Then he has this magnificent shoot, the location to shoot in, down in the bayou, this fantastic plantation home to shoot in, this great little kind of like backwoods bayou bar to shoot in, all this fantastic production quality. It felt like I was watching two different fucking movies. Like, one was a full moon production, and the other one was someone else's low budget attempt at doing like a voodoo mystery in the set in like the Louisiana Bayou. You know, very, very.
And oddly enough, both of them are bad.
And both of them are not. And neither one of them are good. You know, it was like the worst parts of full moon productions. The worst part of like an indie low budget no name. You know, we're working together on this to make this film. The film is fucking nonsensical. The plot is all, they don't explain shit. There's the weird cavalcade of full moon characters, like, you know, like Crazy Bijou, you know, and is there like that? There's a bunch of creepy shit in it. You know, it's like, it's so fucking weird. And really, in my opinion, really fucking annoying in this, because.
So what do you. When you look at Trauma, right, and Lloyd Kaufman, his films are fun.
Yes.
That's the biggest thing, is they're fun. You can get behind it. You still know what's going on, despite the fact that it's sometimes way the fuck out there. You still know what's going on, and you can really get into it. And even when you look at, like, Puppet Master versus Demonic Toys and all, are those films great? No, they're not great. But a lot of them can still be fun. This film wasn't. It was bad.
There was nothing intriguing about it. I didn't give a shit about any of the characters, even though they tried. He tried. They tried to make you care about these characters, but there's not enough time spent with any of them to even give a shit. At least in the first fucking Puppet Master, there was enough time lent that you at least care about some of the people. Okay, even in Demonic Toys, there was at least character development enough. In Demonic Toys, I was curious about, like, what was going to happen to the kid? What was going to happen at the end of this thing? How was it going to play out? That's the whole point. Even in Trauma, Lloyd Kaufman actually manages to make you do that, to actually be invested and care about the characters that are going on. Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead, as fucking insane as that movie is, I cared about what was going to happen with that lead character. I wanted to see where it was going to end. And of course it ends in a fucking car accident. Everybody fucking dies, which is fucking hilarious. That's straight trauma for you. But in this one, it ends with like, everybody's cool except for the dad, whose evil plot to take his son's soul is like confined into the body of this, like, you know, half mutilated parrot. It's just fucking so stupid. And just like the worst of both worlds going into this movie is like, I would say that's what's so wild is that I love the area that they shot in. The cinematography, I thought, of the sets of the where they were shooting, I thought was great. Lighting was good. The sound was solid. But everything else is just so fucking goofy and ambiguous and weird and just not necessary. You know, with all the with all this, it's like I said, it's like watching two different fucking movies. Like they had this thing on script and. There was like too many cooks in the kitchen on this, which is weird because it's one dude. It's David Schmoller. And David Schmoller, who is like legendary in, was like fucking legendary in Full Moon because he directed the original Puppet Master, which I would not expect this movie from that director. He directed the original Puppet Master. He did Tourist Trap. Tourist Trap was fantastic. I love Tourist Trap. Crawl Space was good. Catacombs was good. Fucking Puppet Master is one of my favorite Full Moon films for a lot of people. So the guy's legendary, but then he delivers this piece of shit, which is just fucking weird to me. God damn it. Charles Band wrote this story as well. Fuck.
I don't know if like they didn't care or they're trying to make some kind of statement or they're just throwing darts on a board and go, oh, well, I guess we'll do this, this, and this and put this together. But I mean, regardless, it doesn't make sense. The production quality is at best. It was shot okay. It was decent, but it still felt like low budget. And low budget early 90s is fucking low budget.
Right. Yeah. Very low budget. Okay. So Sir Little Wolf, this Tourist Trap is strange. I grew up with it on VHS. I thoroughly loved Tourist Trap. I really did. I loved what they did with the practical effects in that, but I also loved the inspired casting of fucking Chuck Connors, the Rifleman, as the bad guy in that. And he was great. That he took to that bad guy role, like, fantastically. It reminded me a great deal of Tourist Trap in its casting reminded me a great deal of The Hunt of, like, what was of Without Warning. Okay? The various characters in that one kind of playing outside their typical roles where, kind of breaking out and doing something a little bit different. I really thoroughly enjoyed that. I thought, that's why I like Tourist Trap so much, but Schmoller is better than this film. Charles Band storytelling, it's kind of there, but I almost feel like there was a struggle in between Schmoller and Band on this one. Like, Band wanted to pull it in his direction, but Schmoller had a different vision here, and it's kind of like this pull back and forth, and we wound up getting this lazy, obnoxious, dumb, ambiguous, I couldn't even figure out what kind of fucking, like, magic these people believed in. It's just, like, so fucking random. And the birds thing never gets explained, like, why birds? I think it's just another weird thing. I have no fucking clue. But we did get a guy getting turned into a bird. We did get a guy with a giant bird head in the background of one sequence. He's like, oh, I'm turning into a bird. The shit was, yeah, there were some moments in it that I was like, that's just fucking ridiculous. That's pure Charles Band right there. But here's my curiosity. This is my curiosity regarding this film. Despite how bad it is, I will give it marks on its cinematography and the way it was shot and a lot of the choices that Schmoller made, had his crew make in how he framed some of these sequences and the kind of like the fun inspired, the full moon kind of like things that we come to expect from those kinds of productions. So I will admit, There's some interesting things going on as far as the technical side and the choice side here. The film itself is terrible. It's not good at all. It's like one. I will say, I'm going to go on a limb right here and say, of all the full moon features, and this includes shit like fucking the newest Jack Attack that came out and fucking Bleed, okay? That Netherworld has got to be the worst full moon feature I've ever seen. And I've seen all the Dollman films. I've seen all the Demonic Toys films and their fucking spinoffs. I've seen the Evil Bong shit, Ginger Dead Man. Netherworld doesn't even have something campy like a talking bong or a Gary Busey voiced gingerbread man serial killer to even play off of. It has nothing, campy to jump off anything like that. It's got no springboard. But the premise I found kind of fascinating in an almost Anne Rice kind of way, with the son coming home.
No, you're turd polishing. You are totally turd polishing.
No, not this film. I found just the premise of the film. You think about the premise. Young man pulled from the city to return to his Louisiana roots to inherit the estate from his estranged father. And it turns out his estranged father was this like practicing beaucoup, who intends to sacrifice his son's soul, to lure his son in as part of this plot to sacrifice his soul in order to like live forever, to like, be resurrected and live forever. That's it. Think of that. Leave out the bird shit. Leave out the soul transfer. Just that's the plot. The secretive beaucoup dad is bringing his son back in order to sacrifice his soul to live forever. It's part of a grand plot to become immortal. That's not bad.
So
that's not a terrible premise.
In other words, a twisted version of Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. But take out the bird shit. You can leave in the voodoo stuff, but have it be more authentic to the actual religion and the actual belief systems of that, the actual ideology. bring those back. I'm thinking more like, you know, like Sleeping Beauty meets Sleeping Beauty meets Serpent in the Rainbow, that kind of shit.
See, like, that premise is all okay. Yeah, it could work and everything, but it's just so bad.
No, the film is bad. The premise is basic. The premise is basic. Okay, basic, classic kind of like, you know, hidden information. Protagonist comes in expecting this. All of a sudden, it's part of a grander plot in order to kill him and take his soul. That's just like classic, like, you know, 80s, like 70s, 80s, 90s plot writing right there. But you can do a lot more with it, especially today, with better effects, with better practical effects and better special effects makeup and stuff. You could do something profoundly more interesting, I think. And so my question on this one, and I'm not trying to turn polish the film. I'm not, because Netherworld is bad. But I think the premise has promise. And I think that this premise was simply handled by the wrong people. That Schmoller and Band were not the ones to make this movie. Okay? That someone else can make it. So that's my question for the audience tonight. Ignore all the terrible shit about bird people and fucking, like, you know, weird stuff, but nonetheless, ignore all that and just think about the premise. Is this film remake worthy? Especially with a new fucking name. It would have to be a new name, because Netherworld doesn't even make any fucking sense. It's not the Netherworld. It's like fucking astral projection shit. There's no Netherworld. There isn't. The name doesn't even like match the film. It's just so fucking dumb.
But so basically, it's just like made a different movie.
What the fuck? So basically, just make a different movie. Take the premise out, strip everything else out, rename the fucking thing and do it better. That's pretty much it. I was going to say, is Netherworld remake worthy? I think it is remake worthy. Actually, no. You could keep the title and actually play more into the Netherworld by stripping out all the insane bird shit and all the unnecessary sex scenes. And then maybe put in one for good measure, but then use up that allotted plot space for the Netherworld stuff, for like transferring to another realm. And you could do that. Okay. So yeah, maybe you could do that. Maybe you could keep the title by actually focusing on there being like another alternate plane of existence where his father is waiting to sacrifice his son. I think that could play. So let me know down in the comments below or at weekendhorror@gmail.com. Is Netherworld remake worthy? Could this film be remade so it is more in line with its own title and is actually more intriguing as a film itself? I like that. Rename it Featherworld from Rodan L.S. name. That's hilarious. I like that. Featherworld. Sarcasm says exactly the premise is worthy of a rehash, but the script is so not. No, not the script. No, definitely not. Snake fingers. I like it. See, they don't even explain the fucking hand. The hand is just there. And whenever people are assholes, the hand comes out and kills them and turns them into bird people. I don't fucking understand.
I don't get it. The flying hand. I don't.
It's like, ah, flying hand with snake fingers. Very, very weird. Jay Chris says the premise sounds interesting based on how JL described it. See? You gotta take more of a Serpent in the Rainbow tact, because Wes Craven handled voodoo and voodoo practitioners the best in that film. That display of like the relationship between Boku of white practitioners and black practitioners in the voodoo religion was magnificent. And plus, visually the film is amazing. And Bill Pullman was terrific. So, but yeah, love that. I think that would have saved this film. So, whose hand is it even supposed to be? That's a damn fucking good question, Sarcasm. I have no idea.
I don't know.
It was a hand on a wall. Okay, and then they do the whole sequence where he escapes by putting his hand on the wall. Like, he sticks his hand on the wall. He's like, how do I get out of here? You know what to do. Oh, I do. I do know what to do. They don't explain any of that shit. He's just like, oh, I'm all tied up and about to be sacrificed. No, wait, I know how to escape. And he just escapes. Like, the ropes just go away and he puts his hand there and then the hand like attacks. I don't fucking understand it. None of it is explained. I don't
know. There's a lot of hand stuff going on.
Lot of hand stuff. Extra J says, Manos, the flying hands. Oh, Sarcasm says, Serpent in the Rainbow sets the voodoo bar far too high to reach by low-budget indie flicks. Good point. Good point there, Sarcasm.
That's true.
I just think I think this film should have been more in line with that film. It could have taken, Charles Band could have taken some notes and could have gone in that direction. He could have. So, but he chose not to. Meh, I don't know. But definitely let us know down in the comments below. Go ahead.
So we definitely learned, if you want to watch a voodoo film, then just watch.
Yes, yes. Serpent in the Rainbow. You know, Wes Craven. You can't go wrong. So definitely let us know down in the comments below or weekendorjimbo.com, especially considering the premise, the reworking of the premise that I put out there. Let us know if Netherworld is actually remake worthy, because I think, given that premise with some retooling, I think it is actually remake worthy. I do. I think this is one of those ones that's so bad, that had promise, turned out terrible, and can be made better. That's my interpretation here. What do you think?
We will see. But
oh no! Don't make me do it.
I mean, could it? I didn't think the story is enough for me to go like, oh man, this really needs a review. Because there's a couple of films that we've talked about. I was like, listen, good story, poor execution. Those are the films that hands down, like, should be remade. Really should. This one, there just wasn't enough of a story for me to go like, this should be remade. Like, a super, super, super loose premise that honestly, if you did the same premise, no one would tie it to this movie anyway. So you could remake it and honestly just get away with it, and I don't think anyone would say anything.
Agreed. Remember correctly, there was a there was another film there was a film that came out with Robert Englund called Night World, which I found really, really fascinating. That was actually a good movie, but it does nothing along the lines of this. But I think so. But definitely let us know down in the comments below or weekendhorror@gmail.com. All right. Moving on to our third film of the night.
Hang on one second. Unfortunately, I have to go because my battery of my cell phone is dying a lot faster than I thought it would. So yeah, I must bow out.
Streaming will take your battery out. They definitely will.
So, all right, audience, I leave you in the capable hands of JL to go over the last two movies.
The flying hands are coming to get you. Sorry.
All right, everybody, take care. And I will see y'all next week.
All right, bud.
All right, bye. Later.
So let's jump on to our next film on the list. Released February 7th, 1962. And this one, arguably, I think, is the best one on our list tonight. We have the adaptation of The Telltale Heart. Let's check out this trailer. Let's cue up the terror tube. I love that trailer. I really do. Even though the very end is like, yes, Sarcasm says literally the last scene in the movie. But I love that trailer. I really do. It's a must. Plot Hole is here. Good to see you, bud. Thanks for hanging out with us tonight. Appreciate you hanging out there. But The Telltale Heart, 1960 British horror film that came over in 1962, released here in the States under the title The Hidden Room of 1,000 Horrors. Directed by Ernest Morris and written by Brian Clemens and Eldon Howard, based on The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe, starring the legendary Lawrence Payne, Adrian Corey, and Dermot Walsh. The film follows Edgar Marsh, who is this kind of like nebbish little, you know, shy librarian who has this kind of preoccupation with erotica at the time, literary erotica at the time, and he becomes obsessed with his neighbor, played by the magnificent Adrian Corey, with his neighbor Betty. And then when he sees her undressing one night across the street, because he lives across the street from her, and so even though he is kind of like, you know, off-putting, he's kind of like a, you know, he's a nerd is what he is, he tries to ask her out and take her out. And when they meet, Edgar's friend Carl, played by the dashing Dermot Walsh, eventually Edgar sees the two of them in flagrante in her bedroom through, you, because he can see through their window, and then, you know, proceeds to bludgeon his friend to death, and then the events that you're familiar with, Kara. So it's not the original relationship as conveyed in the original story, but this one is a love triangle where one friend turns on the other one. And even though we know the story, we know what's going on. People say Telltale Heart. It's one of the ones that virtually all of us have read. This one is I think this arguably is held by the actors themselves in the way they portray it. They're telling a story that's been told a dozen times before, you know, and this adaptation, I thought, is magnificent. It's just great. You know, Lawrence Payne was terrific as Edgar Marsh. He captured everything there because I've seen Lawrence Payne in several other productions, and his range was exceptional. As an actor, I thought he was magnificent. So I thought that Lawrence Payne conveyed his character arc beautifully. Carl Loomis, I thought Dermot Walsh was a little on the weaker side on this one because his character is so kind of one note, kind of the dashing guy who is, you know, kind of like helps out his friend Edgar out of like, you know, I guess kind of like a sense of loyalty because he's helped him out because he's kind of a dashing rogue. And so he's got himself in trouble with the law a couple times. Edgar's always been there to bail him out. So, but there's a weird kind of dynamic between the two of them. But then when Betty comes in, when Adrian Corey's character Betty comes in, it upsets that whole balance. Now, of the fact that it's shot in black and white, and it was shot in black and white for budgetary reasons, because this film was produced by the Danzigers. And the Danzigers typically tried to do films that were low budget and tried to keep things as minimal as possible and focus on characters in order to really drive their storytelling, which I thought was smart. The Danzigers were well known for how they produced things, which was they were not in it for the art. They were in it for the business. So, but they were both, you know, brilliant businessmen. So they knew exactly what sold, what worked, what didn't, and they tried to, you know, do it as cheaply as possible to maximize their take. And they, it was a successful production couple. You know, those brothers did excellent work for a long period of time through their production studio. So this happens to be one of their great ones where they casted brilliantly and told the story in a new way. That was they took Clemens and Howard's story and really, really conveyed it really, really strongly. So arguably, the thing that got me on this one was the Danzigers at the time. Even though you had a movie like Psycho came out in 1962 with people like Alfred Hitchcock, who are really, really pushing, kind of like this pushing the envelope when it comes to showcasing what is on screen, especially when it comes to violence or sexual violence or, you know, gore or blood or anything of that nature. I like that the Danzigers took kind of a page out of the Hitchcock book and really pushed there because the sequence of the macabre and the gore of what happened when he beats his friend Carl, when Edgar beats Carl to death with a fireplace poker and then buries his body there and then proceeds to then cut out his heart and tries to, like, you know, stop his heart from beating. All those sequences, if you think for 1962, really pushed the boundaries. And I think and reports were that it was very, very upsetting to a lot of audiences, that it wasn't so much the beating death that got people, but the sequence when he goes back to the body, uncovers the body in the floorboards and tries to cut the dude's heart out and then, like, pulls out, like, shows it to the camera and everything, that people were like, you know, that got people, like, you know, the beating heart in his hand, but it's all in his head. So I loved that the Danzigers was willing to go in that direction and that Lawrence Payne sold this movie straight up. Left-Handed Jedi says, wasn't Psycho the first time they showed a toilet flushing? It was the first time a toilet had ever been shown on screen. That it had never been seen. Like, a toilet being in the bathroom and being shown had never been done before. And Alfred Hitchcock was the first to just show a toilet, you know, to do that, which is pretty awesome. Sir Kev says, if you don't include that one cold blue eye, I can't accept it as the Telltale Heart. There were some elements that were left out of this one in order to retell the love triangle story. I agree with that sarcasm. But I did dig the concept of just the essential concept of the guilt overwhelming someone to the point of mental instability where things begin to fall apart because of the guilt of what they've done. And so I think I got that. I really dug that they captured that. And I think that the Danzigers produce a really solid production. Well shot. Excellent sound, especially for what they were doing with the time they were doing it. The question on this, what really got me curious about this, is that the Danzigers made the choice for black and white as purely for budgetary reasons. It was cheaper to shoot in black and white than it was to do in color, which is obviously the reverse today. It's actually more expensive to shoot black and white than it is in color today. but the same kind of situation that Kevin Smith found himself in with Clerks. At the time that he shot Clerks in 1994 or 1993, it was cheaper to shoot in black and white than it was in color at the time because film processing was more expensive for a color than it was for black and white. So because he was shooting that thing on film and not on digital. So my curiosity on this one is, would, even though, because it was made for, even though color was totally possible and this film could have been shot in color, I found the black and white iteration to be much more in line with the thematic values of what Edgar Allan Poe's macabre storytelling. That really solidifies that. I thought as an aesthetic was made it really good. And I think that color would have actually done this film a remarkable disservice to see that, because not seeing, you know, the dead body and seeing the dead body in black and white and conjuring those colors in your mind, like really cements it further, I think, in the audience's perspective. When he cuts the heart out, that big X on the chest, cuts the heart out and then holds up in front of the camera, all that in color, I think, would have been too much. I think it would have dissociated people away from it. I think black and white was the brilliant decision to do this. Even though it was the cheaper one, I think artistically, I think it works as well. I think it's kind of one of those beautiful little moments where their business acumen aligned with the artistic acumen to make something that worked really, really well. Sir Little Wolf, yes. Romero did the same thing with Night of the Living Dead, black and white for budgetary purposes. It's like it was the cheapest thing to shoot on, and because it was shooting film, and so it was much easier to go that route than it was to try and do a color production. He didn't move into that until Dawn of the Dead, when they were able to afford that off the success of Night of the Living Dead. So both Russo and Romero moved off of that with Return of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead in order to do that stuff. So. Lawrence Payne's performance in this that really fucking sells it. Every single scene has everything you need. So I wish this one got more attention, but I think because of its age and because it's an adaptation of Edgar Allan Poe, people hear the story and they automatically, you know, they know it. And this is one of those ones that you'd want to go back and watch solely for the experience of seeing really phenomenal acting in all three of the main characters, you know, in Lawrence Payne, Adrian Corey, and Dermot Walsh. All three of them legendary actors, especially in British film, that I think could be more appreciated by people today. Just to see this film, and plus it introduced you to the Danzigers and how the Danzigers made films. Because the movies that they had behind them, I mean, it's starting with Jigsaw, starting with their neo-noir crime thriller Jigsaw back in 1949, all the way up to 1962. They did so many fantastic films that I think of people like Spider's Web, Taste of Money, Transatlantic, so many good ones that were in their filmography. So I really, really dug this one. As a matter of fact, so much so that I would argue that this version, the 1960 version, which released in 62 here in the States, that this version of the Telltale Heart is actually the best Telltale Heart adaptation. Just simply for the acting, for the cinematography, for the artistic choices, even though they were business choices, they just happened to align happily. I thought that this was fantastic shit. And so if you didn't get a chance to watch it, it's currently on Tubi. You can check it out there. Really great film. And my question for the audience... And I'm so bummed that Eugene didn't get to stick around, because Eugene, his take on this would have been really, really good. It's like exactly what he'd have to say about the aesthetic in this one and the choices from the producers. And as from a directorial standpoint, I thought would have been fantastic. But my curiosity is, I want to ask the audience, what do you think has been the best adaptation of The Telltale Heart? Because there have been a number of them over the decades. That story's been adapted time and time again. And not just the themes of guilt overriding, of like, you know, guilt manifesting into like, you know, a moment where you have people constantly hearing the heart of their victim, but the best adaptation of The Telltale Heart, because there have been several, much like Phantom of the Opera, a number of other of the great stories of legend. Let me know down in the comments below or at weekendhorror@gmail.com what you think has been the best adaptation of The Telltale Heart. I did love that little nod. There's a little nod to the murders in the Rue Morgue. In the film, it was kind of a blink and you miss it moment where he goes to the Rue Morgue, and I thought that it was really good. When you do Poe, I find that directors do that a lot. When you do Poe, you got to do references to a number of his other productions, a number of the other like pieces, you know, like you'll see like references to The Raven, references to Rue Morgue, references to Cask of Amontillado. And so I really, really love that stuff. Left-Handed Jedi brings up the Vincent Price of Peter Lorre, and it was also really good. It really was. And Sarcasm says there's an animated 12-minute short that does it so perfectly. True to Poe with a bullet. I did catch that one. Really, I think we may have talked about it before. I think we did. I have to double check, or maybe I'm not sure. I think we did talk about that on the show. Tony Regime says The Simpsons. Oh, very good. I like that. Very cool. Really good stuff. But this is a fantastic production, and arguably, I think, is the best. In my opinion, is the best adaptation of. There are many good ones, but I think this one is the best. Even though they took some liberties with the story, changed a little bit to give it a love triangle to make it a little bit more conducive to audiences, you know, and played a little bit more into that dynamic that people could relate to. So, having the woman you've fallen in love with, you know, being stolen away from you by your best friend, that kind of like speaks to audiences. So, I think that the Danzigers, you know, hit a home run with this one. I really, really do. All right. So this is going to be fascinating. Diving into this last film. So I have to preface this. I know that this last film that we're going to talk about has some subject material in it that is really, really extreme. And we can thank the director for that and its conveyance of these things, of these concepts as well. This was a brutal fucking film. So, there's some hard material in this movie coming up. But so, well, I'm just going to give you that preface right there. Released February 8th, which is funny because that's somebody's birthday that I know. February 8th, 2019, we have Lords of Chaos. So let's check out the trailer. Cue up the terror tube. I see Johnny took off because he's got work. So, but I appreciate him stopping by. So that was the hard-hitting trailer for Lords of Chaos. And Sarcasm Price is more of a docudrama with stabby elements. I agree with that, but I would say definitely a biographical horror film, which is really, really fascinating. So directed by controversial legendary director Jonas Åkerlund, and screenplay by Dennis Magnusson and Jonas Åkerlund, based on the book Lords of Chaos by Michael Moynihan and Didrik Söderlund, starring Rory Culkin, Emery Cohen, Jack Kilmer, Val Kilmer's son, and Sky Ferreira. The film follows, it's based on actual events, essentially following a young guitarist who goes by the name Euronymous, who formed the Norwegian black metal band Mayhem, and is often credited, Euronymous is often credited as literally being the founder of true Norwegian black metal. And so, these guys are wildly intense, and of course, you know, the black metal scene, but they take it to the next level as far as their promotion goes, or Euronymous does, you know, given that the image and everything goes along well. After the unfortunate self-unaliving of their lead singer, Dead, played brilliantly by Jack Kilmer, who's like, I fucking loved him so much in this role. And I can see that the talent of his dad has definitely transcended the generation. He has taken it in a whole new way. Jack Kilmer's character, Dead, who is extremely self-destructive and eventually winds up unaliving himself. They wind up bringing on another, to kind of like salvage the band, they wind up bringing on another person who goes by Varg, and this tells the story of the power plays in between Euronymous and Varg. Euronymous, who this is pretty much the imagery of black metal is what he used to promote so that they can actually, you know, be a band and make money doing this. Whereas for Varg, it's all real for him. It's like legitimately it's a movement. But I thought Rory Culkin, the dynamic between Rory and Emery Cohen was truly brilliant. Both of them were, the acting in this film is beyond fantastic, and the direction as well. The hard part of this is that I think what it comes down to is Jonas Åkerlund. Jonas Åkerlund has the capacity. That's where the real meat of this film is. It is in his direction. He captured the story of what was going on between what was going on with Mayhem, with the black metal scene, with Euronymous and Varg, and the church burnings that took place, and the murders that took place. Within this whole span of time, and then the breakdown, the power struggle between the two of them, and then Varg's eventual murdering of Euronymous. is how Jonas tells the story and the brutality in which it is displayed. So Jonas Åkerlund, if anybody's familiar with his work, Jonas Åkerlund, as far as his direction goes, has always been extraordinarily uncompromising. He is, I've loved his films. I really, really do. And there, but all of them, okay, so for those not familiar with Jonas Åkerlund, his background going all the way back to the late 80s has been a music video director. And he's directed for, I mean, he's done music videos for, like, you name them, he's done them. I think for everyone from Paul McCartney to Taylor Swift, Britney Spears, Rammstein, Duran Duran, Candlemass, Lady Gaga, I mean, Nelly Furtado, Roxette, Isabella Scarupo. I mean, you name it, he does. So he's a music video director. But he has a specific style that lends itself very, very well to film. And his very first movie was Spun with John Leguizamo and Brittany Murphy and Jason Schwartzman. That movie is hard to fucking watch. That Spun, directed by Jonas Åkerlund, was like watching Requiem for a Dream if Requiem for a Dream was on meth. That is a hard fucking movie to watch, both in its depiction of the subculture and in the effects of the subculture, and because it embraces both the chaotic, the manic chaos of it and the aftermath and the dramatic elements of it, which are really disturbing. So even though it's kind of like a black comedy, like crime drama film, I actually consider Spun to be a horror film. I really do, because Spun was so fucking hard to watch. It's just, it's almost grotesque in its depiction, but it's unflinching and unrelenting. And so if Requiem for a Dream didn't scare you off of that shit, Spun definitely would. And so that's where I got my first Jonas Åkerlund fix. Then he followed it up with Horseman, which is one of the most intense psychological horror films I've seen in quite a long time. It has Dennis Quaid in a rare horror film where Dennis Quaid plays a forensic orthodontist who is investigating a series of crimes that he's been drawn into that links back to his own son. And it's like this, that one was like brutally savage and uncompromising in its depiction of cult murder, stuff like that. Because that's where Jonas Åkerlund excels. He excels in capturing the grotesqueries of fringe ideologies in their expressions and in addressing the social impact of these things. That is where he is the strongest, by examining the fringes of society and letting those stories play out in their horrific totality without blinking away and giving you everything that's going on. The sequence with death on Eliza is one of the most brutal I've seen in quite some time, because based on what the individual did. And that will be extraordinarily hard for a lot of people to watch. It really, really will. And you'll notice that I felt that Lords of Chaos was so fucking extreme because Åkerlund's third film was Small Apartments. And Small Apartments wasn't bad, but it didn't feel like him, like, because it was a comedy film and he was trying to branch out and do something different. And because it really didn't work, even though the lead actor in that, Matt Lucas, who was a brilliantly talented actor. Matt Lucas was strong in that one, but the film just didn't feel right. And then he kind of like swung back around into Lords of Chaos, kind of like to make up for lost time and make it as brutal and savage as he absolutely could. So the fact that this story is based in something, in events that actually took place, and that it's Jonas Åkerlund handling it, real life events that took place the most savage, unflinching way in these fringe ideologies or these fringe communities that kind of exist on the outsides of the outskirts of society, and the conflicts that emerge between them as they kind of butt heads, you know, because where does the idea of like the authenticity or the poser, where is that line drawn? And so, and I love the fact that storyline wise, he did not flinch away from the idea that mental illness plays a strong role in this. Mental illness, social rejection, isolationism, individualism, the rejection of individualism, and then of course the idea that that the corporation is that, you know, like, so, well, what is selling out, what is not. So I love this idea and where Jonas took this one. Despite the fact that this movie is really fucking hard to watch in some sequences, especially the murder aspects, and there's a lot, there's a lot of imagery of like Christian iconography being torched and destroyed. And then the scene in the woods hunting cats, you know, because the guy who goes by Dead, he had a real problem with them. There's a lot of brutal shit in this movie. And because it has its tendrils pretty strongly in actual events from the people that survived and the people that who were affiliated with these individuals. Fringe Element Society, like horror podcast fanboys. I see what you did there. I do. I see what you did there. Thank you, Sarcasm. I appreciate that. So I think this one would be a really, really hard one for a lot of people to watch. But being linked to actual events, I think makes it all the more terrifying, because that which is real is often more terrifying than fiction itself. Because fiction is always, you can see, it's kind of based on things we're aware of and things we know. But the horror of what happened with Euronymous and the band Mayhem and what happened with Varg, the horror of that real life stuff is always terrifying in that respect. And the fact that this went down in this nature, I find, compelling and absolutely terrifying in that. And that it reminds you that there are individuals out there that are like this. And so I think for some people, this Lords of Chaos may be a little bit too hard hitting, that there are people out there, rare individuals, but individuals out there who are just a little too close to the line, or maybe pretty far over it, that they're out there. They live amongst the, they wander about, and you never know, you know, what's going to happen. It's just really, really intense shit. So, but I got to give it to Jonas Åkerlund for his savage and uncompromising filmmaking, and not allowing artistic liberty to overwhelm or overshadow the actual events. I think that this story paid amazing tribute to both the legacy of Euronymous, the legacy of Norwegian true black metal, and conveyed that in the most honest way possible, in a way that I think Euronymous himself, not to speak for the man, or for the subculture, but I think that he himself would actually appreciate this I think it was much in line with what he envisioned. I think he would love it. I do. But yeah, this is a really, really intense look into a subculture that, you know, true horror, absolutely. Casey Cooper said true horror. It absolutely is. And plus, you know, there's some tough shit, some really hard shit to watch in this, but you know, the people who lived it, man, really, really intense. Fucking craziness. I don't recommend it for everybody. I really don't. I do not recommend it for every single person out there. There's going to be some, like I said, unaliving is in this, mutilation is in this, animal, there's like, you know, it's simulated, but of course, you know, there's, you know, a lot of concepts that are deeply hard to deal with. And so the film is not for everybody and would upset many people. So, but if you are familiar with the band Mayhem, if you're familiar with the Norwegian black metal scene, if you've never seen this film and would like to kind of like a glimpse into the history of this, I recommend reading the book as well. But I think Åkerlund did an amazing job in conveying this, which is a shame, because his next film after this one, even though it starred Mads Mikkelsen, and it was about an aging serial killer brought back into the fold. I don't think that movie did not do good at all. I think what was it called? Fucking Polar. That one did not. That one was not good at all. And he recently was replaced on his next film, Midas Man. He was replaced on that by Sarah Sugarman. So I don't know what Jonas Åkerlund is doing nowadays or what he has planned. But Sir Little Wolf, it was Cats. Real problem with cats in this film, and some pretty gruesome depictions. So just throwing that out there. I don't want to spoil anything for people who haven't watched it. It's available on Amazon right now. But like I said, really the performance in this film are absolutely amazing. Rory Culkin knocks it out of the goddamn park. Sky Ferreira, even though being a music artist, Sky Ferreira is amazing. And the other, everyone else in this portrays their roles to an absolute T. I loved every element of it. And but it's saying with Jonas Ackerlund's direction, with his cinematography, his unwillingness to turn away from the most extreme shit and to really convey the horror, like the true horrors of reality. He was the guy I think he was the only director who could really convey this in the way that it paid homage to Euronymous and Norwegian Black Metal and to really tell the story as it was meant to be told. So, but yeah, if you can handle it, definitely check it out. It's on Amazon right now, but it will not be for everybody. But the question that I want to ask, given his controversial nature and his very, very unique style, what do you think has been the best Jonas Ackerlund horror film? Now, there's not many, but I consider Spun to be a horror film. And if you've seen Spun, I think you'll agree with me that that movie's a fucking horror film. Lords of Chaos, definitely a horror film. The guy knows. But what do you think has been the best Jonas Ackerlund horror film? Or maybe even just his best film overall, like the best Jonas Ackerlund movie. So, because Lords of Chaos was fucking wild. But he, yeah, I mean, Horseman was goddamn intense as well. So seriously, but definitely let us know down in the comments below or weekendhorror@gmail.com what you think has been the best Jonas Ackerlund horror film, or maybe even just your favorite of Jonas Ackerlund's films. So love to hear what people think about that. Sarcasm says, true horror is not in our stories, it's in our lives. Stories help us process it. Ksenia Ansk, yes, absolutely. I would agree with that. I would agree. Sarcasm says, I agree. Spun is a masterpiece. That movie is fucking brutal. It's like, it's almost as like if you took Darren Aronofsky's Requiem for a Dream and took out all of the artistic license, like all the artsy shit, and just did a fucking stone cold glare at that, at the methamphetamine culture. That shit was fucking savage. Jason Schwartzman, Brittany Murphy, and it's savage and it's fucking sad, you know? Brittany Murphy, Mina Suvari, Jason Schwartzman, John Leguizamo, and Mickey Rourke. You know, that just is fucking raw. Yes, sarcasm, just raw as fuck. You know, it upsetting in some ways, you know, just really disturbing. But, you know, true to form, what it is. Jonas Ackerlund, he knows how to cast his films. He really does, because I don't think he could have gone any better with Rory Culkin in the role of Euronymous and the depiction of the early years of mayhem and the cavalcade of interesting characters that came along with that. So definitely check it out if you've got the stomach for it. All right. Well, it's about that time, and I think I'm like right on schedule as it is, but it is that time. You know what time it is. It's trivia time. Hell yes, trivia time. All right, so I've got the live chat pulled up. So, be the first person in the live chat to get the correct answer to this trivia question, and you will win a special item from the Week in Horror store. Man, this trivia question closes out January for us, and then we are fully in February. So, God, it's already speeding by. You know, season 5 started in September, and now we're already in, we're about to be in February. February tomorrow, it's friggin' wild. So, but be the first person in the live chat with the correct answer to this one. I've tried to make it a little bit tougher. So definitely, you know, may take a little bit of this. So get those Google fingers ready. Here we go for a special item from the Week in Horror store. What 1958 movie was the first known publicly released Norwegian horror film? What 1958 movie was the first known publicly released Norwegian horror film? First person with the correct answer in the live chat gets a special item from the Week in Horror store. Check out that link down in our description. All kinds of cool stuff there. Who's going to get it? Who's going to get it? Who's going to be the first person with the correct answer? Oh, people are looking. People are hunting. No one has said anything. Left-Handed Jedi is the first one. Yes, well done. Left-Handed Jedi with Lake of the Dead. Well done. Or they... The Dota's Turn, I think, is how they pronounce that. But it's Lakes of the Dead, but I will accept Lake of the Dead. Yes, was the very first legitimate Norwegian horror film released in 1958. I found out through looking into that Norwegian film really didn't take off. It had been around since about the 1920s is when cinema started getting produced there. So, but it really didn't take off until post-World War II. after World War II, very similar to Italian cinema. Italian cinema, especially horror cinema, really didn't blow up until after World War II. And so that's when we started getting the meat of that stuff, was after World War II. Then, of course, technology began to disseminate and everybody had access to it. And of course, you know, in the post-war boom, people had the opportunity to start and make movies. So Sarcasm said, didn't have a clue, and I refused to Google. No Googling for Sarcasm. Case Cooper, yep, the Dota's turn. I don't know how to pronounce that. I don't speak Norwegian. So, but congratulations, Left-Handed Jedi. That's two. You won two this month. So I'm going to write your name down, and we will get that printed and shipped to you ASAP. Congratulations. And Lando Lakes of the Dead. That's funny. I wrote in the last name. So that, Horror Fiends, is going to conclude this episode of the Week in Horror Podcast. Man, another one down. And thank you so much for joining us. We really hope you enjoyed the show. And if you did, smash that like and subscribe button and be sure to hit that bell so you never miss a future episode. Join us next week when we look back at the original ultra creepy The Stepford Wives, The Silent Brilliance of Nick Cage and Willy's Wonderland, the original horror of Mystery of the Wax Museum, and the savage and bloody Clive Barker nightmare, The Midnight Meat Train. Got eclectic choices next week. Be sure to check out Josh Olson's store, BadSamurai.store. He does all the awesome artwork. You see splattered all over our merchandise, which you can find down in our link to Teespring down in the description. And for more from Week in Horror, check out all of our bloody links. Follow us on the socials for the daily splatter, your daily horror recommendation. Join our Discord for watch parties, big announcements, all kinds of horror shenanigans. And support the show through channel memberships by joining the Army of the Dead, Super Chats, PayPal, or even through our Patreon for as little as $1 a month. You can help us do all this cool stuff every single week. What are you waiting for? Join us! As always, I want to thank personally each and every single one of you for being the greatest audience a horror film podcast of a bunch of fringe fanboys could possibly have. We love you all so much. We'll see you all next week. And as always, you can say it with me, stay scared.